Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich and Fascinating Ohio, a show that highlights the achievements of people who live, work, or have ties to the Buckeye State. It's estimated that 120 million people will tune in to the Super Bowl on Sunday, many for the commercials, if not for the game itself. And this year's Doritos commercial will be brought to you by an Ohio native, Dylan Bradshaw. Dylan and his co-director Nate Norrell have won the coveted spot in the lineup by a vote of the people. And they won $1 million. Dylan joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Dylan.
Amy, what's going on? I'm so stoked to be on.
Thank you for being here. Congratulations on your big win.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's still hitting me.
Have you come down? You're still up on the high of the win. I'm sure you haven't come down yet.
Oh, yeah. It's been an insane week. We were just live on the Today Show to announce the win. And then we're going to be at the Super Bowl live while it's happening. So it's a crazy week.
So you made a commercial about Doritos, and then there was a contest, and it was a nationwide contest, and you were a semifinalist and then a finalist. Tell me about that process. Why did you decide to enter the contest for Doritos?
Yeah, so when I first found out about the contest, there was only like less than a month left to submit. And I'm a director and a filmmaker out in Los Angeles, already making my own projects to chase the dream of directing movies. And my friends also make their own projects. And I just saw it as a perfect opportunity to make something cool within the parameters of the contest, of just making a 30-second Dorito ad that's bold and creative. And regardless if we won or lost, we'd have a fun project to add to the portfolio. But it's just so crazy to see how far it's gone, you know?
Yeah. And so the commercial is very visual. I can't really play it on the radio, but basically it is about an alien trying to steal Doritos. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, totally. So the premise, it's a UFO that tries to abduct a bag of Doritos from like an alien fanatic in the middle of the woods in his cabin. And once the bag is being abducted, the fanatic, as expected, takes it a little personally. I mean, once you try to take my Doritos, that's pretty personal pretty quickly. So he gets into a tug of war that escalates with the UFO. And people have to check it out when it's live on the Super Bowl in the first quarter. But it was a blast making. I mean, I'm a big science fiction fan, love Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, and trying to make something that I loved, the alien concept kind of came naturally. And a lot of my friends who we workshopped it with loved the concept.
Now, when you became a finalist, it was between you, it was three commercials to vote on, and then one would win. You and your co-director kind of just went all out with TikTok videos telling people to vote for you, right?
Yeah, we had to go on like a full-fledged social media campaign because it was all based on voting. So we were posting on every platform. I mean, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. I mean, we were also on Reddit, just trying to do as much outreach as possible with social media, trying to go viral, and with our personal communities as well. I mean, I was doing daily reminders in like over 30 group chats just to keep the fire alive. And we had to spice up the content too, just to keep people entertained, starting with like cinematic behind the scenes and then evolving that, a week into like comedy and more heartfelt with the narrative, just because we needed people to vote every day for 14 days. I mean, I can't remember the last time I did anything like any sort of habit for 14 days straight. So voting was just crazy to imagine.
Now, we mentioned you're an Ohio native. You're from Dublin here, very close to Columbus. Did you have all of Ohio on your side trying to vote for you?
Yeah, that was a goal. And it was actually really cool to see how much support we got. I mean, the whole city of Dublin, I'm from Dublin originally, went to Kauffman High School and born and raised in Columbus. But seeing the Dublin City Schools community come through for us, and so many other people that know my parents, Jeff and Kathy Bradshaw, and my brother Dane Bradshaw, his friends, and my friends all coming through, it just felt like everyone was ready to charge into battle for us. So, so proud to be an Ohioan, and it really rolled deep on this contest.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, a weekly show where we talk to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. And with us is Dylan Bradshaw, who made a fan favorite Doritos commercial that will be shown in the Super Bowl on Sunday. So you grew up here in Columbus. Did you always want to be a filmmaker?
Yeah, I think I got into filmmaking pretty young. In sixth grade, I got my first camera around when YouTube was becoming a thing, and realized I could show my own, quote unquote, movies to the whole world if I was just posting on there. But yeah, I mean, my parents were always encouraging me to be creative and are also great storytellers. And yeah, I just dove into it, making videos with my friends. And also, Steven Spielberg is from Ohio as well, so I'm just trying to fill some big shoes.
Yeah, just to keep that Ohio a filmmaker buff alive. So,
Yeah.
yeah, did so your Ohio roots, do they inform you in your aesthetic as a director, from Doritos commercials to other things that you've worked on?
Yeah, I mean, I think having the background of being from the Midwest and raised by a great family definitely has influenced my perspective as a filmmaker. I try to keep all of my projects as personal as I can. I mean, obviously I haven't been abducted by aliens before, I don't think, at least, but just my love for the outdoors and for adventure definitely stems from being a Boy Scout and loving the outdoors in Ohio as well. So I think that translated at least to this specific Doritos ad. But yeah, definitely trying to pull from my personal experiences. I mean, the most personal is the most creative, as Scorsese says. So yeah.
Do you come back to Ohio to do any filming, or are you pretty much LA bound now?
Yeah, I'm mostly based in LA, but I would love for Ohio to offer some more film opportunities. I mean, I would come back in a heartbeat just to work on projects. I mean, I have a couple feature film ideas, one specifically that I would love to make in Ohio, and I know the industry is starting to grow out there as well, which is great to see.
So you moved to LA in 2020 without a job. What was your plan?
Yeah. So, no job, no friends waiting for me. I just had this, deep calling almost just to jump out there. I mean, I want to direct features, and Los Angeles is, it seems like the place to be, either that or New York City for that kind of pursuit. And yeah, I just started networking through social media. I was using Instagram as a portfolio to show my work, and through that was connecting with other filmmakers that were around my age and doing some really cool stuff that was inspiring to see. And pretty quickly on, I mean, that first week, I went to a birthday party that was just all people that I'd never met before. They were just friendly enough to invite me because they'd seen my work and kind of got a good idea of who I was. And through this party, I met like my co-director and best friend Nate Norell, who at the time was working for Zach King, who is a big icon on social media and also a great filmmaker. So through that, it just kind of snowballed into what my career is now, just having worked with Zach and Nate in doing my own projects and learning so much about not only filmmaking, but like social media, which translated directly into the social media campaign that helped us win the Super Bowl contest for Doritos.
Yeah, Nate seems pretty good at TikTok.
Yeah, he's great. He's got like 6.2 million on TikTok, and yeah, he's brilliant when it comes to the social media strategy. He just has done his research, which is really cool to see.
And he also spent a lot of time eating a lot of Doritos in some of the videos that I saw. You did too, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know what's so funny is after all that, we both realized that we still somehow love Doritos, which is hilarious. But
I was going to ask you if you got sick of it, but you can't say that because, Doritos is,
yeah,
Doritos
but
is your
I won't.
Doritos is your favorite now, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's funny. I'm a big nacho cheese guy, and Nate is a Cool Ranch, so it's a house divided. But yeah, Doritos still, after all of the eating, and we even did a 24-hour live stream where I said the word Doritos 100,000 times. That was wild, and somehow still I do love Doritos genuinely. So
The senior vice president for PepsiCo Foods called your commercial the ultimate embodiment of Doritos for the bold ethos. So, is that did you try to have that bold ethos phrase in mind when you were making your commercial?
yeah, oh totally. What an awesome compliment to get as well. But yeah, no, we watched like literally every Doritos commercial on the internet when we were coming with our idea, and even workshopped like 50 plus ideas in a Google Doc just until we landed on this one. And yeah, for the bold was their tagline, and I think our idea really landed on that. I mean, he's what you know what's more bold than getting in a tug of war with alien spacecraft over just a bag of Doritos, but respect, honestly.
So your commercial will be shown in the Super Bowl, did you say in the first quarter?
Yeah, I believe it'll be in the first quarter live as the official Doritos Super Bowl commercial, which is so epic. I think it's like at least $7 million to just show the ad live for 30 seconds.
So, and where will you be? You get to go to the Super Bowl. Is there like a Doritos box you get to sit in?
Yeah, it's so wild. We'll be in the Doritos suite at the Super Bowl, watching the game live. And I've never been to the Super Bowl, so this will be an insane experience for me for sure.
Chiefs fan, Eagles fan? Neither. You're are you an Ohio pure?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if the the Browns or the Bengals are in there, I'd be cheering for them. But I'd probably decide with Patrick Mahomes. I mean, he gave us a little shout out on Doritos, which was really cool. And he's seen our ad, so might just have to respect the shout out as well. And he's got an awesome career.
And we did get an email from one of our listeners, Julie. She wants to see you collaborate with 21 Pilots to make a music video. So there's
Oh.
you're like, sure, call me.
Wow. Yeah, no, that'd be great. That's so cool because they're also Ohio natives. That would be an awesome. I'm totally game for that for sure.
So what are you going to do with your share of the $1 million prize?
Oh man, great question. Initially, I was thinking blowing it all on Legos, but I'll try and control myself with that. But yeah, I mean, I would love to, reinvest it into my own career with Nate, doing our own projects, whether that's narrative pieces like films or future commercial campaigns and specs. But also I definitely want to be very smart and wise with it and just reinvest it to have a long lasting positive effect on my life and my career as well. But would also love to donate a portion to some charities and organizations that I love, most likely wildlife conservation related. So yeah, looking into what that might look like.
Wow. So what is next for you besides the $1 million? Because, that can open some different doors. But what was prior to winning this, I'm sure you had plans in the works of what was happening next. What's next for you?
Yeah, great question. I would love to direct feature films. So ideally, this could be another step towards, getting connected with the right people, the right studios and investors to get a feature film greenlit and done correctly. But yeah, diving into movie production and development, more commercial campaigns. I was already directing a lot of really cool branded content with like different brands and influencers and celebrities prior to this. But I mean, this is just the next level. I mean, the Super Bowl ad I've been coining is like the Oscars of commercials. So hopefully some pretty high caliber campaigns and future film projects in the works. And a 21 Pilots music video. I mean, that would be genuinely a dream come true. So that'd be cool. Ohio Unite on that
Ohio
one.
Unite. Yeah, and I was just going to say, now you have a little bit more money in your pocket to fly home to Ohio a little more often, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I genuinely love coming home. My parents always joke. I love coming home during the winter, especially because then I get at least a week or two of snow. But then once I'm tired of it, I dip out. So
Well, that is Dylan Bradshaw. He and his co-director Nate Norrell were made the fan favorite Doritos commercial that will be shown in the Super Bowl on Sunday. Dylan, thanks for being with us today.
yeah, thank you so much, Amy. It was such a blast.
And coming up, we're going to talk to the CEO of the Columbus Museum of Art. That is when Fascinating Ohio on All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk to Ohioans with an interesting story to tell. Brooke Minto came to Ohio in 2023 as the new executive director and CEO of the Columbus Museum of Art. It was a transitional time in the arts field as museums worldwide emerged from the pandemic that shuttered their doors. Brooke has more than two decades as an administrator, art historian, and educator, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Brooke.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we start talking about what's happening with you here in Columbus, let's start with your own beginning. So you grew up in a suburb of New York on Long Island. What sparked your love of art?
I think it was in part just that, the proximity to New York City and really the opportunity to visit museums and galleries quite easily when I was, in my school age years. I grew up in a family that was very much interested in the arts, visual art, music. My parents collected art from the Caribbean, and always instilled in me a love of the arts. We would travel, go to studio visits with artists. It's just something I've always had as a part of my life. It feels very intuitive.
And you studied art history, but you also have a master's degree in critical studies. So, what is it about the contemporary art that spoke to you?
I think it's something that I've always been challenged by. And when I decided to do my graduate work in critical studies, it was really about focusing on writing. I think it allowed me the opportunity to articulate my ideas about contemporary art. It's always challenged me. I'm not one of those people who've understood everything the first time you see it. And I think that's why interpretation is so important to the work that I do. And so pursuing writing and writing about art really helped me to sort of articulate my ideas and think through so many kind of conceptually based art practices that I was being exposed to, in the contemporary art world.
Now, you have worked at museums in South Africa, New York, New Orleans, and Miami. What drew you to Columbus?
A lot of things. People, first and foremost, the opportunity to work with really amazing people who, were my introduction to this position and to the opportunity. I think the museum is very fortunate to have great leaders who had a vision for what the next chapter would look like here, and they sought me out. I knew very little about the Midwest or about Ohio until I came to visit. And when I landed, I was really surprised and delighted by the museum, the collection, learning its exhibition history. And then I learned more about the city and this really dynamic moment of change that Columbus is in. Something that, is a common thread, I think, to the other places where I've lived is that Columbus is in a moment of real transition and change. We all know the economic development numbers were expected to grow from 1 million to 3 million population in the next decades. And that felt really exciting. The opportunity to lead a museum that's growing alongside a very dynamic city is a special one. And so I decided to move inland.
So, do you feel like an Ohioan now? You've been here, it'll be 2 years in May.
I'm getting there. I know being certainly someone of Columbus is to be a sports fan. And so I am a very big Columbus Crew fan. I spend a lot of time thinking about the Columbus Crew and how they're doing. So that's my team.
What's your take on the art scene locally here in Columbus?
It's really interesting. And you know what? It is so specific to the city. It is this incredible blend of creativity, creative practitioners, community, education. We have some really wonderful artists who live and work here. Anne Hamilton, Carmen Winant, Diane Lee, and Claire Rojas. Many of them are not only living and working here in the city, but they're also teaching. And so we have this kind of dynamic interaction of universities and teaching practices, along with artists who are pursuing really wonderful and kind of independent work. And it's all quite accessible. I've been really enriched by the relationships I've made with artists and faculty here in the city, and that we've been able to draw connections with between the museum, the university, and others.
Now, you came to Columbus from the Black Trustee Alliance for Art Museums. You served as its inaugural director. Can you tell us about your role there and how you hope to benefit the museum community overall?
Yeah, so in 2020, a really visionary group of trustees got together from major museums across the country, trustees of color, to think about the way in which a way in which they might help to advance the work of the museums they were on boards of. And through this initiative, the Black Trustee Alliance was established. It was funded primarily by major foundations, Ford and Mellon Foundations, and then they asked me to be director in early 2021. And this initiative was really not only visionary, but I think continues to be quite impactful in that it allowed us to commission research into what the Black trustee experience is like so that we could really understand what were the experiences of these trustees, how can we make their work more impactful, and how can we create a scenario where trustees are educated and empowered to partner with their directors towards greater board diversity. And so that's what I did for the first couple of years launching the organization. We drew in several hundred Black trustees, more than we imagined existed across the country, of art museums, specifically of art museums to start. And we did research and we got to know everyone and what their experiences were like. And we were also fortunately embraced by the museum directors across the country who understood and appreciated the importance of the work. And, you know, the work is ongoing. While I've moved on and I'm here at CMA, I have a great successor there at BTA. And, you know, BTA continues to partner with institutions, their directors and their trustees to further advance diversity work on their boards.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. And we're talking with Brooke Minto, the CEO of the Columbus Museum of Art. Now, the George Floyd's murder was a worldwide reckoning of race and social justice. Museums across the U.S. also had a reckoning with their history, having created a European model for a lot of the art, one that relied on telling the story from a white man's view of history. So you've spent your career working to make museums more inclusive, the art more worldly. Can you talk about bringing that vision here to Columbus?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what I do. My work is always centered around expanding access to art and really amplifying diverse perspectives and thinking about how we make museums more inclusive places. And really bringing people together and creating that kind of connective tissue. So as I, you know, rebuild our curatorial department here and I think about, you know, how our collection will grow over the next several years, I'm really thinking about the kind of global conversations that are most relevant to what's happening in this city, to what's happening with the change in population in this city, and how those global conversations, you know, intertwine with what's happening here in our community and kind of bringing the two together, the global and the local. And it impacts everything that we do exhibition-wise and in terms of programming that we offer to our visitors, to our members. My hope is that, you know, our programming and all the content that we provide helps everyone have a kind of greater understanding of what's happening more universally and really gives them language to share with new communities and to find greater understanding amongst our sort of diverse perspectives.
The Columbus Museum of Art just began a national tour of the art of Amina Robinson, titled Journeys Home, a Visual Memoir. It started February 1st in the Springfield Museum of Art. What do you hope visitors learn from her Amina Robinson's career?
Amina is a phenomenal story, and she has such a tremendous legacy. So just by a little bit of background, she passed away in 2015, but during her lifetime, she had a really wonderful relationship to the museum. Her parents encouraged her to pursue art. She took classes at the art museum beginning at an early age when the museum still ran an art school and pursued her career as an artist, but always remaining an educator and teacher. And when she passed, she left her estate to the museum. So we have this really sort of unique opportunity to shepherd her legacy, which, you know, doesn't happen often in museums. So we maintain her home studio. We also have works that she left in her estate that we make available commercially. The proceeds of the sale of those works maintain a residency program that we hold in her home studio where artists come throughout the year to have residencies. So there's so much to learn from her. She always had an understanding of the impact of her work and that it would be meaningful well beyond her life. And so she started this conversation with the museum very early on about her archive and about her estate and how she wanted that to be able to support future artists and to encourage them to pursue their careers and to give them space to experiment. So I think there's just so much that we can learn from her as a model. I wish I had had the opportunity to meet her. You know, I've gotten to know so much about her legacy, what she was like through her writings and through oral histories that we fortunately have recorded. She was an extraordinary person and had many friends, fans, and followers here in Columbus and across the country.
This national tour of her art, is it years long? Are you taking it to as many places as possible?
It is. We have five venues that we're in conversation with, three of which are confirmed, and the show will travel through 2028. So after Springfield, it travels to the Newark Museum of Art, where the deputy director for curatorial affairs there is actually a former chief curator of CMA. So we've got alum in Springfield and Newark who have helped us tour this show. And then it'll go to Mobile, to Alabama. The final two venues will be announced shortly, but we're really excited that it'll travel through 2028 in that that will be the 150th anniversary of the museum. So it's very poignant that this show will be touring until we reach that very special benchmark.
And there are efforts at the federal level to erase the words diversity, equity, and inclusion from government and industry. How do you navigate that type of change in the art world?
Well, it's certainly something that's very dynamic and changing every day. I feel very fortunate that I have a group of colleagues in AMD, the Association of Art Museum Directors, who we lean on to talk about these things. The new orders are affecting museums across the country very differently, of course. But at the end of the day, our work is about the pursuit of excellence. And you know what that looks and sounds like varies, but that is always going to be at the forefront of what we do and what we celebrate, creative excellence.
You mentioned, some nonprofit organizations have certain budget things that involve the federal government. Does anything without any of these directives apply to the Columbus Museum of Art?
Not yet. I mean, we're fortunate to have quite a bit of government support right now, especially for some capital projects that are coming up this year at the museum. But at this moment, none of the announced changes are impacting us, and we hope that'll stay that way.
Now, in a 2023 Columbus Monthly interview, you talked about wanting the museum to reflect Columbus's immigrant community. Can you tell me what the museum is doing to, the Somali, Brazilian community, Nepalese? What are you doing to welcome those types of families into the museum?
So we were very fortunate to receive additional support from ArtBridges Foundation as I arrived in 2023. That allows us to continue our Free Sundays program. It's a program that already existed at the museum, but with their tremendous support, we've been able to extend Free Sundays for another 3 years. Sundays are open to everyone, open to all, and our hope is that it gives community members, new and old alike, the opportunity to access the museum and to really step into the museum for the very first time and see what we have to offer. And from there, hopefully become members and repeat visitors. So Free Sundays is really that entry point for us, and we hope everyone will take advantage of it. We have about 250,000 visitors a year, of which 40% come on Sundays. So we know it's an effective program. We know it's a really wonderful entry point because a lot of families can come together. When you're here on a Sunday, you see grandparents and grandchildren, you see families of all kinds. And so that's really a point of access. Moreover, we are thinking about our exhibition program and how it can be more inclusive. Last fall, we did a really wonderful show that was inspired by our sister city program with Kral Ghana in 2015, just before he left office. Former Mayor Coleman established a sister city's relationship with Accra, the first sister city on the continent for Columbus. And so we opened a really wonderful show that focused on contemporary art making in Accra, as well as of artists of the Ghanaian diaspora who live in Europe and the United States. It was a really wonderful exhibition. We promoted it at Ghana Fest, which is a wonderful festival here because the Ghanaian population is one of the largest African immigrant communities here in the city. And these are the kinds of programs that we're continuing to sort of research and mine and form partnerships with in various cultural communities so that we can create meaningful exhibitions, festivals, and other kinds of partnerships.
And I wanted to save some time before we run out of time to talk about some of the exhibits happening now at the Columbus Museum of Art. Is there any one in particular you wanted to highlight first?
Well, I know Think Outside the Brick, the creative art of Lego, is very beloved in our city. We do it every holiday season, and it remains on view for March 13th until March 13th. So if you're a Lego nut, you've got to come see it. I'm also especially excited that we have extended the run of one of our two recent presentations of Ming Smith. This exhibition is called Ming Smith, August Moon, and it's on view in Gallery 5, our photography gallery in the historic Ross Building of the museum. Ming is a wonderful photographer who has lived and worked in New York for many years, but who hails from Columbus. She was raised in the Hilltop. And she carries this amazing distinction of being the first woman of color to have been acquired in the photography collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1979. So, we are just really proud that she is from Columbus, that she is such a phenomenal photographer, and that we can celebrate her here in the museum for the very first time. We had two solo shows. One remains on view through May. And we've also recently acquired our first work by Ming Smith for the permanent collection. So that's an exhibition I'd love everyone to see before it closes later this spring.
And there's also an exhibit called New Encounters, Reframing the Contemporary Collection at the Columbus Museum of Art. Can you talk to me about that? There's some familiar names in it as well.
Yeah, so when I landed, I guess in 2023, I had the opportunity to reinstall our post-war and contemporary collection, which sits in the second floor of the Walter Wing, our now 10-year-old new building. Mm-hmm. I worked on that reinstallation with Danny Marcus, who's our curator of collections and exhibitions. My particular specialty in art history is post-war and contemporary art. So it was a really wonderful opportunity to dive into the collection. Our collection is now just shy of 15,000 objects, but to really dive in and get to know, you know, what we have to go through storage, to bring things out that may not have ever been exhibited or not exhibited in many, many years. And so it is really selections that the two of us wanted to see and to show, sometimes again for the first time, others for, you know, the first time in many, many years. But we reinstalled the whole second floor of the Walter Wing. So it's about 8,000 square feet. There's over 100 works on view, ranging from, I'd say, 1945, 1950 to the most contemporary works that have been made in the last few years.
And you have been the leader, we said, of the Columbus Museum of Art. You're approaching 2 years. What's next? What is a goal you have for the next year for the art museum?
Well, something that's really excited that I know the team and I are just thrilled to share is that we are going to reopen our second campus this summer. We were very fortunate in 2018 to be given the gift of a building in the Short North by the Pizzuti family. Ann and Ron Pizzuti showed their collection in a building at 632 Park Street for many, many years, and then donated that building to the museum. It's been closed on and off due to the pandemic, but we are now recommitted to programming in that space. So we'll open with a new exhibition in July, and then we'll continue with full-time hours from July onward. It's something we've been planning for quite some time since I arrived, and we're now happy to share that in mid-July we'll open with hours once again and continue to program there. It's a space where we'll be able to show, you know, more experimental art, work with living artists on new commissions. And so we're really happy to have that space and to reintroduce the museum to a new audience in the Short North and all the neighboring areas.
I had completely forgotten about that Pizzuti building. I used to go see the Pizzuti collection all the time. Wow.
Yeah, it was much beloved. It was much beloved. And it also was a place that had a lot of activity. You know, wonderful artists would come to Columbus, give talks. So we're hoping to reactivate that, to really create community conversation around contemporary art. And so beginning in December, we started doing pop-ups as a kind of warm-up to our full-time opening in July. And so we've had 3 artist talks now with hundreds of visitors and participants. And you can feel that energy coming alive. People remember that time and are excited that it's going to return.
Wow. Well, I'm excited now because my brain, I guess the pandemic, you know, shrinks your brain, and I had forgotten that existed. So,
well, now you'll have a place to go. And, you know, we're thinking we'll stay open late on Fridays. You know, it's really fun and buzzy and Friday nights and Saturday nights in the Short North. So we're going to stay open late so people can come on in and see incredible exhibitions, come to talks, film screenings. And so we're planning for that now and, you know, getting ready to be a 2-campus museum again.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to have you back in July whenever you officially open.
That would be my pleasure.
Brooke Minto, CEO of the Columbus Museum of Art, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Amy. Have a great afternoon.
And coming up, Columbus is now home to its first Rage Room, and we're going to talk with the owner. That's when Fascinating Ohio on All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we meet neighbors doing interesting things. Have you ever felt so stressed or anxious that you just wanted to break something? Well, I've got the place for you. It's called The Wrecking Company, and it's Columbus's first rage room experience. It's a recreation company that invites you to come in and break stuff. And here to break it all down for us is Kate Zenger, the owner. Welcome to All Sides, Kate. Yeah, let's try that. Welcome to All Sides, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So the goal of a rage room is to break stuff. What made you want to open a business like this?
Well, actually, a few years ago, I was working at a marketing company at a corporate retailer. And we were all very, very stressed for the past few months of working on a campaign. And I joked that we really needed a place where we could all just go and break something in between meetings. And I asked our boss if we could actually just break a few things for that the IT department didn't want. And of course, they said no, understandably. And but the idea stuck with me. And finally, during COVID, I thought, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to open it. Felt like more people needed it than just me.
Okay. So what is the goal of a rage room? It is to release some stress. Tell me about your mission.
It is. Though I think even though it's in the name rage room, you don't have to be angry to come. I think it's a lot more about release. And so the goal is really to be able to come and do something you've always been told not to do, to break something, to make a mess, to scream, to be loud, to take up space. And have fun doing it in a safe and controlled environment. So our goal really is to let people do something exciting safely and leave happier and lighter and better.
So you are Columbus's first rage room, but there are places like this in other cities.
There are. That's actually what helped me, excuse me, get the idea off the ground. When I started researching, does Columbus have anything like this? I started finding that other cities did. But Columbus, there was nothing near us or, I mean, within hours. So I waited and waited for it to happen and finally just did it.
It had to be you.
I guess so.
So what made you decide to call it The Wrecking Company?
It's a great question. I did not want something that said smash or rage or because, you don't have to be angry. We didn't want to bring this aggressive image or tone to the space because you bring the aggression, right? We bring the safe space. So it is really how you feel. You feel a little bit of a wreck. And then afterwards, it's all wrecked. So The Wrecking Company felt like an accessible name for people instead of an aggressive name.
Okay, so you book an appointment either by yourself or with a few friends. You book a room, and then what happens?
So what happens is you come in for your session, you fill out a safety waiver, and then after that, we give you a large white blank plate, like a dinner plate, to take to our plate bar. We have a lot of markers there. You write down whatever you might be mad at, what you want to rage about, whatever is on your plate. And after that, you get geared up in our safety gear. You choose a weapon, and we lead you into your room where there's a crate of breakables waiting for you. Then you would hook up your playlist to a Bluetooth speaker in the room, and then you rage.
So, okay. So can you bring multiple friends? What's the capacity?
Yeah, our larger rooms can hold up to six, but based on feedback we've had from previous customers, we've actually suggested about up to four in a room. And if you have a larger group, we do have a viewing window into the room. So your friends who are waiting their turn can actually look into the window, watch you rage, and get excited for their session.
Okay. So you could take turns if you have a larger group than four. Okay. So now tell me about what we're smashing here. So I understand the plate, you know, the idea of like writing one of your grievances on a plate and then breaking it sounds very cathartic to me. I'm excited to do that. I would need multiple plates, I think. But maybe I can fit them all in just one. But then what else are we smashing?
So we have an entire range within a crate because we really curate each crate to have different size breakables and colors and textures so that you get a full experience. So we put in there alcohol bottles and beer bottles. Thank you to the bars and restaurants around us. Couldn't do it without you. And then mugs and figurines and vases and wine glasses, whatever the thrift store people would like to give us. And typically we get our breakables from thrift stores who, you know, these are the last stop. things aren't selling, they have chips in them, they're going to go to the landfill. So that's where we get a lot of those.
So you're the last stop for some things before they hit the landfill. So you're just smashing them smaller before. Right?
Yeah, though we do try to recycle everything. We work with recycling partners. So if, you know, we do offer add-ons like electronics, like computer screens and printers, because everybody wants to play out that office space scene where they all smash the printer. Mm-hmm. So we do offer those as well. And then we pick apart all the pieces to get properly recycled to the best of our ability.
So if I want to smash a printer, is that like an add-on cost? Or whenever I book it, I can check mark, I really want to smash a printer.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's an add-on. So everyone gets their creative breakables, but then we do have things that you can add on to your session to make it exactly what you need.
Where do you get like printers or computers and stuff?
We work a lot with government liquidation. So auction sites type of deals, things that are broken already from colleges, from businesses. And that's where we get most of those.
Can you bring your own stuff? What if I have my old printer from college that I still have in the basement and I want to smash it?
No judgment. yeah, you definitely can. The caveat is we do need to look at everything before you smash it to make sure that, one, it's safe for you. We don't allow anything toxic in there, like old tube TVs. We can't break those. But also, especially for printers, all the printer ink is out in the toner. You know, we don't want a huge mess of the room. So as long as you let us look at it first, feel free to add it to whatever we're already providing you.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with the founder of Columbus's first rage room, the wrecking company owner, Kate Zenger. So you mentioned safety equipment. Let's talk in more detail about the safety equipment because we want to make sure everyone's nice and safe. So what do you have? You have something that people have to wear.
Correct. We have long sleeve coveralls that are like a work coverall. And then we have hard hats with visors. We have safety glasses, and then we have cut resistant gloves as well. We also offer ear protection, earbud like plugs for people who might be sensitive to sound. And we ask people to wear closed toed shoes.
Right. I saw you had a note specifically, no Crocs.
Yes. No Crocs.
Yes. You got to protect the feet. And then you said that when you go in, you pick a weapon. What are those options?
So right now we have baseball bats and then short billy club type bats, golf clubs, wrenches, crowbars, things like that. But they're always kind of shifting and changing whatever we have in. Whatever doesn't break.
Now, you're a relatively new business. When did you open?
We opened the first weekend of November, so we are just a little baby business.
Okay. What are you? Are you busy? What kind of reception are you receiving?
We are incredibly busy. Yeah. Oh, we are booked out right now for the next 3 weeks for groups. Solo sessions can kind of have a better opportunity to come in as a walk-in and get a spot. But it's been incredible. The reception has been amazing. Columbus is amazing. So it's been really busy and fun.
Tell me about some of the groups you've had in. Like, what did they tell you about why they decided to do this, to book this event?
Well, I will say probably 90% of our customers are female.
Oh, wait, that's telling. interesting.
We've had a lot of breakup groups. You know, somebody's coming to support somebody who's going through a breakup. We've had divorce parties. We've had a lot of birthday parties. It's been really fun to watch these groups go in supporting somebody, come out, and that person is just glowing. You know, it's been really rewarding.
Now, that you go in and you're a recreation company, so you're going in and the event is spending this time breaking stuff. You don't have like food or a bar, right?
We don't. If somebody wants to book a private party, we do have a little area where they can set up food that they bring, but we don't sell anything now.
Okay. Is that maybe a future goal or is that too big? You're too new. You're a baby company. Don't push me, Amy.
It is definitely something that we have talked about. We definitely want to at some point offer water or something. I mean, this is a workout. People are going in for 30 minutes. They're lifting a heavy bat and smashing it over and over. They're coming out sweaty. So we eventually would like to offer some kind of refreshment. And in the future, if we ever expand to a second place, we would love to possibly explore the opportunity of expanding it. So it's not just a rage room. It's also, you know, somewhere else where they can relax with stuff.
Have you been to ones in other cities?
I haven't.
So you just kind of saw them online.
I did. Yeah. Uh-huh. I've talked to lots and lots of people who have been to them because, I mean, anytime someone says, oh, this is my second time or a third time or whatever at a Rage Room, I grill them afterwards. Mm. What did they do better? What can we do? How did you like it? Because I want to make sure that it's exactly what people need. It's not just, oh, we went and broke something for a few minutes and it was great. I want it to feel better than that. I want it to mean more than that.
Is this a side hustle? Do you still have a day job?
Yeah, we do still have day jobs. My husband, I could not do this without him. He is a freelance photographer for retail studio photography, and I still have my full-time marketing corporate retail job.
Do you both rage sometimes, or have you already taken your swings?
You know, we don't often, because every piece of glass to us is precious now. Every time I go to a bar and see bottles, I'm just like, oh, gosh, glass. But if something is chipped beyond, you know, we don't like to give people broken things. Obviously, mm-hmm. That's the fun of it. It's breaking it. So if something's broken in our supplies, we'll go into a room and throw it, get a little aggression, a little stress out.
Tell me where you're located.
We are on South 4th Street. We're very close to Dirty Franks and 16-Bit, right there at 234 South 4th.
Okay, so what was in the space before. What did you have to do to turn it into a safe place for people to smash stuff?
Yeah, a lot of sound insulation, mm-hmm. for sure, because we didn't want to bother anybody around us with the sound of it, and a lot of floor protection and a lot of fake walls that we have put up so that nothing of the original building gets touched.
Mm. Okay. Well, The idea sounds amazing, and I want to break stuff, but it also sounds very messy for you to clean up. Like, who cleans up? What's the cleanup like?
I do. My husband does. It's actually, if we're not too busy, it's kind of meditative, actually. We go in with a large broom, and we push it all to the corners, and we shovel it with a big snow shovel into trash cans, and then we take like a little broom and do all the detail work, because we do clean between each session, mm-hmm. because we want everyone to come into a clean space so that they can then make it messy on their own. And it takes like between 5 and 10 minutes, more if there are electronic pieces that we have to go through and pick out, because again, we want to recycle those as responsibly as possible, and so they can't go in with the glass. But yeah, it's a lot of physical work, but it's kind of nice too.
And I didn't ask you how long a session is. So how long are we smashing things for?
A group session is 30 minutes. You get more pieces in your crates. A solo session is kind of what I consider kind of an express rage solo session. So you get in for about 20 minutes. You have your crate and you're in and out.
Mm. So how many do you book a lot of solo sessions? It feels like a group activity to me, but maybe I need to go alone. Tell me about the alone experience.
Yeah, I think it is a very different experience, mm-hmm. from the group experiences, especially if you come with a significant other. I've seen people be a little bit maybe more reserved with their significant other than with let's say a girl group, where they're like cheering and there's a lot of like joyful noise coming from the room. A solo session, I feel like, is where a lot of the work gets done, mm. where there are a lot of tears and yelling, and as much as we soundproof the space, you can't sometimes help but hear the reaction in those rooms. And I think, you know, a lot of people leave with red eyes and feel lighter, and I feel like a lot more work gets done in that room.
You said people can bring their own music. Do you have like a favorite song that people have smashed things to that you would have never thought of?
Actually, we had somebody come in with opera and sing along in the solo room, and it was gorgeous. And again, I try not to hear, but we do have a viewing window there, and I kind of just walked by. And
you were drawn. I bet you were drawn to the opera music.
Yes, it was gorgeous, yeah. And something that I never would have thought, because a lot of people play, you know, upbeat, get their heart pumping kind of songs, like a little Rihanna breaking dishes type of vibe. But this was different. It was really beautiful.
And you said you opened in November. Do you have a lot of people tell you, the climate we're in now, you know, life seems heavy, news is heavy, there's just a lot coming at you all the time. Was it the right time for this place to open?
Yeah, you know, we actually did that unintentionally. It just happened to work out that was the weekend that we opened, was the weekend before the election. Mm-hmm. And it has, I suppose, benefited us in some way, because people are there. The climate is pretty at odds, and people have a lot of deep-seated fear and anger and frustration right now, and they don't know what to do with it. And so here we give them a safe place to express whatever they're feeling without judgment. So it was good timing, and unintentional timing.
And so we have less than a minute left. So just tell people how they can find you and book something and get on your schedule to break things.
Yeah, they can go online, thewreckingcompany.com. There's a big button that says book now. If there is not a session time that works for you that you can find, please email me. I respond within a day. And it's info@thewreckingcompany.com. That's the best way to find an appointment that you can't seem to find online.
And you offer, you recommend maybe four people, but you offer more because mm-hmm. you can do it in like a rotating session and watch each other if they want to have like, you know, a group from an office or something.
Yeah. So if you don't want to do the private party option, which is when we shut down the entire space and mm-hmm. you get the run of the rooms, you can book up to six in a room to rage together, or you can book back-to-back sessions. Just email me. Let me know what you need.
All right. Thank you to Kate Zenger, the founder of The Wrecking Company. Thanks for joining us, Kate.
Thank you so much.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News.